I have finally upgraded my home network.
And what prompted this upgrade?
I'm glad you ask. What prompted my upgrade of the network was my daughter having a terrible network in her rented university accommodation.
What? Hang on. What?
Yes. So Sophie's away at university and she's just started a new year because it's the new academic year. And she's moved into new accommodation with three of her friends. And it has all the usual amenities and services, including wireless networking.
Right.
Now, Sophie's room is the furthest geographically from the wireless access point.
Mm-hmm.
And she called me up a couple of weeks ago and said, there's a bit of a problem. Because I'm so far away from the wireless, I don't get a good signal and my phone keeps dropping off the Wi-Fi and I'm burning through my data on my phone. And if I want to work on my laptop, I have to tether to my phone because the laptop can't reach. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to help her solve this problem remotely. So I got her to go and take a photograph of the wireless access point because that was the easiest thing to do. It's just like, just take a photo of it. I'll figure out what it is. I said, take a picture of all four sides, all six sides of this thing. So she did. And it was like El Cheapo Sky internet thing sat underneath the TV. So you can't really move it because it's like near the telly and all where the phone line comes in and all that kind of stuff. So I asked on my favorite location for asking for technical support, Mastodon, if anyone knew of a way to, you know, make network go further. And a few people, you know, made the usual suggestion of, oh, you need to upgrade to what they called Unify or something. There's some very expensive equipment you can buy. And I'm not going to do that for her rented house, for her and her friends. Someone recommended TP-Link Deco, and I had never heard of this.
No, nor have I.
Right. Well, I've got a couple of TP-Link devices in the house, and I've heard of TP-Link, but I'd never heard of this brand Deco. Apparently, it's been around for a while. I went looking on my favorite online store, and I found some, and I thought, oh, that looks good. But what I should do is make sure it works, and I'll make sure it works at my house. And if it works at my house, I'll have better internet and then I'll tell her and she can buy the same ones and put them in at her place.
So is Deco just a good wireless access point brand or is there more to it than that?
It's like a branding. Like there are a number of different types of units.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much all look like white lady cylinders. And some are indoor, some are slightly ruggedized for going outdoor. There are some tall ones, short ones, some as big as your head. And different models are compatible with different wireless standards and have different number of sockets on them and stuff like that.
Right.
So I bought a set for myself because my network is pretty ropey here. I've got a decent wireless access point in the bedroom where my cable internet comes in and then everyone else could just suck it because the rest of the internet around the house is a mishmash of Ethernet over power and a couple of random old access points dotted about, right? Because the one in the downstairs bedroom doesn't reach to the opposite corner of the house. So I thought, I'll buy these Deco things. So I bought a pack of three. It was £100 for a pack of three access points. And I want to tell you, this is just fantastic. It's super easy. You have three in a box, three power supplies and one Ethernet cable. And you take the first one and you plug it into your internet, however you get your internet. And there's an app for your phone that goes through the setup process, much like you'd set up a lady cylinder. You know, it connects to it and then you tell your what your wireless network is going to be called. And it creates a new wireless network. Then you get the second one out and you put that somewhere else in the house and you just plug it into the wall. And it doesn't have to be plugged into any networks or anything. It's just plugged into the wall for power. You set that one up. It connects to the first one through the power of wireless and then creates a wireless network where it is. And then you get the next one and the next one. And you put as many out as you like. I've got three and they're kind of staggered around the house and they all centrally connect to the one that's physically connected to the internet. Although actually the one that's connected to the internet is actually connected to an Ethernet over power thing that then goes to another room and connects to the, I've got to fix that. It was just the first place I could plug it in was in the lounge where there is a Ethernet over power thing, but it's great. It works. All the clients seamlessly move from one deco unit to another. If I wanted to add more, I could buy more and put another one somewhere. If I wanted to put one in the garden, for example, I could. There's a ruggedized version, or I could put one down the end of the garden if it's a bit further away. But it does NAT. I've actually got two levels of NAT now because I've got the NAT that the deco is doing and then the NAT that my, you know, domestic router is doing. I might replace them, but I'm not sure yet.
In terms of moving between points, are they each a separately named network and your phone moves between them? Or is it all, do they all have the same name and then your phone picks the one which is giving the strongest signal? Because in the past, when I've tried doing a sort of mesh network thing, I found that sometimes my device will hang on to an access point with not such a good signal as I move around rather than dropping it and switching to the nearest one.
That's precisely the problem that I had previously, and I do not have this problem with these deco units. It has one network, so they're all called Popey, and wherever you are in the house, it just connects to the right one and figures out which is the right one to connect to and connects to it.
When we recorded Ubuntu podcast, I did a home network upgrade, and I looked at the deco devices, and from what I remember, they create a wireless mesh network, right? So you get this one SSID and they do all sorts of clever things to figure out like what's the fewest number of hops to get to the source point, and they prioritize the traffic and they do all sorts of clever stuff. And Deco is the branding from TP-Link to describe their collection of devices that have this mesh capability, I believe.
Yes. The model I've got is S4, which I think are Amazon exclusive ones. They're quite cheap. And they have two Ethernet sockets on the back. The one that's near the internet, where the internet comes in, that one's plugged in with a cable. The other two have no cables attached to them at all, just the power.
Right.
But you can attach them to the network if you want to. You don't have to because they've got this whole mesh capability, but you could plug them into the network. You can also plug devices into them as well. So if you've got a desktop computer,
right,
you could plug a desktop into one of them. They're quite versatile.
Yeah, so I think the dual Ethernet ports, you could optionally have wired Ethernet as the backhaul between the devices rather than them use a wireless network to provide that connectivity between the nodes of your mesh.
Yeah, if you have an especially like very bricky house with like chunky walls and, you know, ye olde construction that's like hard to get wireless signals through, then maybe you might need to do that. I haven't had to do that and it's been pretty robust and the kids haven't complained. So ultimately, it was successful. I then told Sophie, you should get them. So Sunday, she phoned me up and said, is now a good time for you to walk me through how to do this? And I'm like, I can walk you through it, but it's actually pretty easy. And so she put one in the lounge near the TV.
Mm-hmm.
She put another one out in the hallway. And then she put the third one right in her bedroom. And she gets perfect signal.
Brilliant.
She was using like fast.com on her phone and on her laptop. And I told her, just forget the other wireless network. Just like delete it from your phone and just use this one. And you will have great success. And she shared the credentials with her housemates so they can all use it. They all benefit from having a better spread of wireless. But yeah, plus one. Would buy these again. They're good. It gets a Popey cheap Wi-Fi recommendation, 5 stars.
Very good. And I should just add in closing that if anyone's wondering what Lady Cylinder is, Alan's referring to Echo Dots and things of that nature, the home assistant speakers.
As I may have mentioned in the past, my gaming opportunities these days are a bit more limited than they used to be. I don't have, you know, a whole Saturday to myself to sit there playing games anymore. But more recently, I've noticed that my daughter is getting interested in playing games herself. So this has given me the opportunity to play a bit more myself because I can now play games with her and I'm parenting, right?
Yeah, it counts. It's allowed. Yeah. It is valid parenting, yes.
But there are some challenges to gaming with a three-year-old.
Is she not very good at 360 no-scope headshots? Is that a problem?
Well, yeah, suitable games is certainly one of the challenges. What games can a three-year-old get their head around and play effectively and enjoy? They don't have the longest attention spans. they tend to wander off from the point or just say, ah, I'm not going to play for a bit, you play. And they don't have very big hands, so holding a big controller is difficult. Like, she's tried playing, when I've been like holding the Steam Deck or like a Switch Pro controller, she's tried using it, and she actually has to reach her other hand round the back if she wants to press a trigger. She can't like hold the front and reach the triggers at the same time. That just doesn't work for her at the moment.
Do they do like kid size full Xbox controllers with all the buttons?
There are.
Ah. I mean, I remember on the original Xbox, I think when they released in Japan, they actually released a smaller version of the controller because the original controller was enormous.
Yes.
And they found that, yeah, in some markets, just the average hand size was smaller. They weren't specifically designed for kids, but yeah. I've not actually looked at sort of third-party controllers designed for kids.
Yeah, so I have looked at that. It was Xbox-licensed controllers that are smaller. And I forget all of the brands, but if you search for Xbox controller small, you will find that there are several manufacturers that cater to that market, and several of them are actually quite decent. I will look through my notes and put a couple of links in the show notes to a couple that I've found in the past.
Great. So I have had some success. The first point I thought I should try is some sort of educational games. And forever, there's been a suite of educational games on Linux called GCompre, which is, you know, it's really good for just sort of the really basic computer skills, how to control a pointer, how to type, things like that. Because one of my daughter's favorite things to do when she sees me use the computer is come along and say, can I type? And, you know, she starts mashing on my IDE and shoving loads of stuff into my program.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really handy just to be able to bring up GCompre and say, there you go, just mash the keyboard until you get bored.
I have discovered with all of my nieces that desire just to make characters appear on the screen is very strong with all of them at sort of, you know, preschool age.
Yes. And also just point and click as well.
Right.
Just clicking on things and making ducks go quack and things like that.
Yep.
I've not tried it yet, but I found out that there is actually a version for Android, which I assume is sort of touchscreen based, because she does have a tablet with some games on that she plays by herself. And the instinct when she sees my laptop is to start poking at things on the screen as well.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to try the Android version.
When Sam was tiny, for controllers, when he was too young to really play, the Wii controllers were pretty good because they're like, you know, kid friendly. And we would just not put batteries in his and we would play the game and he would be waving around like playing bowling.
Yeah.
He would think he's bowling and we would stand behind and just like flick the ball.
Yeah.
And he thought he was playing a game because he had the low attention span and he would wander off.
Yeah.
We could carry on playing and he'd disappear with a controller that had no battery in it.
I did try things like that a little bit at first, but the illusion didn't last long, let's put it that way. She quickly figured out that it wasn't working when she was trying to do stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of illusions that don't last very long, the period of time where GCompre and sort of the very sort of kindergarten type preschool educational games, they came and went very quickly. They got accustomed to them and bored with them very quickly, and they were looking for a more engaging and challenging experience quite quickly.
So I have had some success with actual, you know, fun games as opposed to educational games. And what I cottoned onto was there was a thread on Reddit a little while ago about this idea called Little Buddy Mode, which is something that some games have, and I think Sonic 2 was given as the archetypal example, but it's getting a bit more common these days, whereby the game has a sort of co-op mode, but it's a sort of asymmetrical co-op where you don't both have to do the same thing. And in fact, player 2 can just sit there and do nothing, and everything's okay. You can still play the game perfectly well by yourself. But when they want to chip in, they can. They have something to do. And the example that I found was actually on the Nintendo Switch, because the Switch controller, their Joy-Cons, are nice and small and perfect for kids. I mean, it's something that I think Nintendo really thought of when they were designing that, was can a child effectively use these controllers? And you can turn them on their sides and use them with both hands, and they're really good for that. And the game that I came across was Pikmin 4, which came out recently. And Pikmin's a sort of exploration sort of resource management kind of game where you're going around and collecting things and exploring things and doing challenges. But there's a co-op mode whereby the second player has a controller and they get a little target on the screen and they can throw rocks at stuff. So you come across a creature and you've got to fight it and they can help or they cannot help and it's fine. And in doing that, that's enough for her to get engaged, to ask what's going on, to follow the story. But if she doesn't actually feel like playing, then that's fine as well. And she's got used to what the controller buttons do, that they've got letters on, and the ones with different letters I can say, now you press the one with A on, now you press the one with X on. And she gets, yeah, you know, nice. If she wants to recenter the cursor, she presses X and there it is. And then she's got motion controls to move it around. And it's actually really good. We're getting on really well.
Nice.
Yeah.
When I started with the games, like proper games, I actually wound the clock back and used NES emulators and some of the sort of early NES games. I did try the arcade games, but that was complicated by the fact that you have to understand it's a virtual arcade machine and you're putting coins in it. And explaining that concept was just too much. So actually using emulators for consoles where all of the buttons on the controller are the thing that you need to do, and it's just start and play and moving around. And I used recreated NES style controllers because they are quite small and they've only got the two AB buttons and the directional pad. And we started with some simple games there, things like the Mario games.
Yeah.
But what I discovered was when my daughter was younger, any games that had like a time limit, she got quite a lot of anxiety about being put under pressure by the game. So we had to sort of find games which didn't apply pressure or concern or jeopardy. And we quickly moved on to Steam. And there was a couple of games on Steam that we really found to be great. And one is Tokitori, which is a puzzle game, which is sort of very much turn-based, and you can wind the clock back. So if you make a mistake, you can just sort of rewind back to a different point and make a different decision.
I think Pikmin has a similar concept. You have a rewind time option.
Yeah. And then the other thing that was hugely popular was when my daughter discovered Scratch, and then Griffpatch, I think their name is, who is a prolific Scratch developer, and they write loads of games and re-implement popular games in Scratch. And a lot of my daughter's early gaming was actually on Scratch, playing games that people have published on Scratch.
Oh, nice.
In terms of Jeopardy, Sam's most frightening occurrence was when his character in Minecraft would go underwater and Sam just couldn't get him to swim back up again and he'd start drowning. And Sam would like scream at me from the other room, he's drowning, And I'd have to come running in and hit the space bar to make him swim upwards. I was like, dude, just press space. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But some of those games that have a bit of Jeopardy are quite hard.
Yeah. But yeah, I'd love to hear from anyone else who's listening what sort of games they like to play with, particularly with young kids, particularly sort of little buddy mode style games. Really interested to know what other ones there are to try out.
I have built an entirely solid-state NAS. It's passively cooled and it has no moving parts whatsoever.
And what are you storing on this NAS?
It's been a while since we've had a home server, and I'm using it to reserve our archive of DVDs and Blu-rays and CD dumps that I made last decade or whenever it was. We cancelled a bunch of streaming services earlier in the year that we didn't feel we were getting full value from, and we've reinstated Plex as one of the things on this server and our back catalogue of stuff to sort of fill in the gaps that you can't get from the couple of streaming services that we've kept around. So that was sort of the main crux of it. But it was also an opportunity for me to experiment with some spare parts I had, because this is the most ridiculous way to build a home server, I'm sure, but also to experiment with using NixOS as a server.
So is this just a box with an SSD plugged into an Ethernet port?
Oh, no.
Come on, Mark. Of course it isn't.
So the first thing is there was a NUC that was made around 2016 called the Skull Canyon NUC, and it was the first gaming NUC. Now, you can just ignore the gaming bit, but it was a decent performing NUC. And I got an aftermarket case for that NUC, which is made by Akasa, and it looks like a TIE fighter. And you take the main board out of the original case and you put it in this large finned aluminium case. And it's an entirely passively cooled case. So there's no fans. It's got a whole bunch of heat pipes that radiate out to these TIE fighter-esque blades at the edge. And the whole thing is passively cooled and therefore silent, which is actually quite a desirable property because the fan in the original Skull Canyon NUC was massively whiny. And Joe, our producer, used to complain endlessly about the noise coming from my little NUC when I used to record podcasts. So that bit's silent. But then I had a Thunderbolt enclosure that takes multiple cards that was gifted to me. It's a hand-me-down from a Apple Mac Music Studio. And the purpose of this multi-card Thunderbolt enclosure is you put multiple sound cards in it in order to create, you know, a sophisticated mixing studio using, is it Pro Logic or Logic Pro? One of those.
So when you say cards, we're talking PCIe cards?
Yes, PCI Express cards, yeah. And it takes three of those. It's two that are 8x and one that is 4x is what's in there. So I was gifted this, and I also happen to have a couple of interesting cards, which are PCI cards that you can put four M.2 SATA sticks on each card. So these are not the 2.5-inch drives. These are the drives that look like chewing gum sticks, but these are not PCI Express NVMe drives. They use the SATA protocol, so they are slower. But you can put four of these drives on each card. So with two of these cards, I can have eight drives inside this Thunderbolt enclosure and then connect that Thunderbolt enclosure to the back of the NUC. And now I have eight drives available.
Which obviously you've set up as a giant pool of ZFS, right?
Well, you were close. You're a couple of letters off there. A giant pool of XFS is what I have.
Got it.
So each of these cards has four terabyte SSDs on it. So that exposes a total of 32 terabytes of storage. And then due to the RAID that I'm using, that's actually 24 terabytes of usable storage, which is a significant upgrade from the 6 terabytes that I had on the spinning Rust that we originally had connected to this.
You say they're slower. They're slower than NVMe would be, but they're still significantly faster than a spinning drive would be.
Yes, indeed. So the theoretical speeds is around 540 megabytes per second sequential read and write for each drive. And when they're aggregated, each card of four, I can push data through a whole card at the speed of a single SATA SSD. So I get that sort of approximately 500 megabytes of throughput.
If you're like streaming films from it, unless you're doing it in 8K and there's six people in the house doing it, surely it's not going to be a problem.
It's not.
You didn't do this for the speed.
Well, I don't know what else is on there. It can't just be Plex. There's going to be other stuff on there that's you know, maybe more intensive.
There is other stuff on there. I didn't do it for speed. I mean, for example, when I'm streaming stuff off this, I can saturate the gigabit interface that the Ethernet has on this device with overhead to spare. So I could be doing large backups internally on the device, and streaming, you know, movies don't actually compete with one another. So it's by no means bleeding edge, but it's more than adequate for a home server for streaming stuff. And because this Skull Canyon NUC was a gaming NUC, it's got all the hardware on the CPU to do hardware accelerated transcoding. So you can actually sort of, you know, take your 4K stuff that you ripped off your Blu-rays, but stream that over like 1080p down to the devices on the network. So Plex was where this sort of started, but I was then interested in, well, what else could I do with it? And the first thing I wanted to do was, because there are no fans, I wanted to make sure this thing wasn't overheating. So I installed NetData, which is very nice. If you've ever used anything like Grafana, it's like Grafana, except it works intelligently by default. So what do I mean by that? It enumerates your system and automatically creates a whole bunch of time series metrics based on everything that's on your machine, hardware and software, and you can then create alerts from that. So it was very easy to actually just make that go and then actually check on all of the important stuff. So I quite like NetData for sort of home users. It's a really nice way to monitor your server without spending ages getting into sort of, you know, proper, let's call it web scale solutions. I set up a simple DNS server as well, because I wanted to do that. So I have an ad block enabled DNS server that which uses AdGuard behind the scenes. And then I mentioned Plex, and we've also got Tautuli installed as well.
What's that?
It's sort of analytics and monitoring for Plex. So it keeps a track of what was watched, when, from what devices, by who, and it starts to build profiles of habits, and it gives you an idea of like, well, what's popular and what should we have more of on the home server and stuff like that. But it's just another bit of insight into Plex and how it's used.
Nice.
And then all the usual bits and pieces. So we've got sync thing running. So it's another full-time running sync thing. So the devices, either on the LAN or remotely, are all connected to this. And Dropbox Headless is running there as well to synchronize the things to provide a backup point for our Dropbox stuff at home. And then Samba, because I want to be able to drop things into the server from time to time without having to SSH in. And it's all working really well. And I think the thing that I've been really impressed with in terms of the NixOS side of things is how quickly you can add these services and get them fully configured and up and running. It's usually just a case of saying this service.name.enabled equals true. And it's rare that you have to do anything more sophisticated than that to bring these services up. And in particular, configuring Samba was delightful by comparison to how I've had to sort of wrangle the smb.conf file in the past, which is often not overridable with, you know, .d style override files. So, you know, package upgrades tend to clatter it.
Yeah, I've never found Samba config to be a fun job.
Yeah.
So now you've got all this storage and it's all silent. Is there anything left you could do to improve it? I mean, is there room for more storage? Is there room to tweak it in any further ways?
Yeah, I think what I'm going to do is daisy chain another one of these enclosures and use that as a backup target and run the backup to not spinning Rust, but to another solid state array. So this is Borg, which we talked about in our big backup bonanza. And the other thing I want to do is, because NixOS, I want to experiment with running my own binary cache. So this is effectively like my own proxy and mirror of the software archive or repository that you would get in other distributions. And that will then accelerate my build times and deployment times for my devices. So that's something I want to learn about. There's a really great bit of software called Garage, which when I figured it out will also be featuring in a future episode. So it's really building on this as a platform and a base now.
I'd be interested to hear what people do about home servers at home. I know some people still run like microservers and some people use old laptops and stuff. I'm keen to hear from our listeners, and maybe we'll collate some of this stuff and put it in a later feedback episode.
Yeah, good idea.